Okay, good evening, everyone. Welcome. My name is Ethan Tucker, and welcome to Mechon Hadar. I want to thank everyone for coming. A couple introductory thank yous. Thank you, first of all, to the many friends and supporters who are here. It's always great to learn with you. And to folks who are here for the first time, thank you for coming out and being a part of the culture of learning Torah that we are deeply committed to in this space. Thank you also to the various rabbis who are joining us this week for our rabbinic intensive seminar over these 3 days. Really have brought an added voice of Torah to the Beit Midrash. And thanks also, of course, as always, to the full-time Yeshivat Hadar fellows who anchor this space as a place of Torah for the broader community. We're going to begin tonight a three-part series, investigation into the topic of Judaism and ethics. It's a topic of abiding interest that I think is relevant and gripping in some ways at any moment and place in Jewish history. But it is also one that I think we have to admit has gotten increased attention in recent years. Particularly when there have been tragic and even horrific instances of prominent Jews in very public spaces being caught up in various kinds of scandals that involve unethical behavior. And that has been at times in the financial industry, at times in the food industry, sometimes in the context of sexual scandals, sometimes money laundering. There have unfortunately been no lack of examples of late of prominent and even observant Jews failing to meet our aspirational ethical standards. I don't intend to hand out any indictments during this series, and I also don't expect in any way to make that problem go away. But our goal, as I see it, over these next 3 evenings, is to figure out how we can have deeper awareness and self-understanding on this topic. Specifically, can we find some kind of a language, a shared language for speaking about Judaism's relationship to ethics, human dignity, universal morality, and even natural law that can serve to somehow bind and direct us as a community? Is it even appropriate, as the title of this series suggests, to talk about Judaism and ethics in that kind of a dyadic way, as two forces that somehow have to be reconciled and are maybe sometimes in conflict? Or when we pose that dichotomy, even if we only do it in language, have we already indicated that we are in some way off course? Now, the series is going to deal with 3 distinct, you can enjoy them one shot each on their own, but still interrelated topics. We're going to begin tonight with an analysis of the Akedah, the binding of Isaac, which I think is the starting point for any serious engagement with the interplay of religious commands with moral and ethical imperatives. Next week, we'll take that conversation into the realm of rabbinic texts, looking at a critical Talmudic passage that tries to work out that tension. And then in the final week, we'll look at a very bold, modern take on the relationship of Judaism to basic ethical human norms and think about whether it is or is not a useful model for our own contemporary moment. All the lectures will be in an interactive format. I hope and expect that you will raise questions, comments, and arguments along the way. And we'll also try to have some time reserved at the end for sustained question and answer. So let's begin tonight with the Akedah. You hopefully all have a source sheet that you got when you came in. And try to take on this question of whether Avraham Avinu, Abraham our father, was in fact asked to sacrifice his ethics. Now let's start with the obvious place here, which is that the Akedah is a central, deeply central Jewish text. Right? It's not only a part of the Torah. There's many parts of the Torah, but it is not only part of the Torah, but also the climax of the cycles of narratives around Abraham. That is to say, its place within the Torah itself has a kind of climactic moment to it. But beyond that, it's of course a key liturgical piece. It's a key element of the davening. It serves as the Torah reading on the second day of Rosh Hashanah, and it serves in the middle bracha of the Musaf Amidah, kind of in the climactic middle of the Amidah, as the centerpiece of our plea to God. At the end of that middle bracha, that nine bracha amidah, we really scream out at that moment, Va'akedat Yitzchak hayom lezaro berachamim tizkor. We beg God to remember the akedah and what happened, and even the text there plays out in much more narrative form. She'akad Avraham Avinu et beno agav amizbeach. Right, the notion that what Abraham did in binding his son on the altar is something we want God to remember for all time. The problem, the akedah, is seemingly an act of attempted murder. Right? And the notion that we put up as one of our centerpiece texts, liturgical pleas, something that we would normally view as an act of heinous, unethical, run amok human violence is, I would say, pretty well describes the major tension that many Jews feel with respect to the akedah. Right? How is it that I have this thing that is so central and yet is so contraindicated by everything I think I know about ethics and morality? Okay? Now, just to play this out, in section one, just brought you two sources, one biblical and one rabbinic, that I think only reinforces the dilemma here and how we're nervous about this. So, Dvarim, Deuteronomy chapter 12, pretty much says it as clearly as you would want to hear it. Lo ta'asechein Adonai Elohecha, ki chol to'avat Adonai asher sanei asu le'elohehem, ki gam et b'neihem ve'et b'notehem, yisrefu va'esh le'elohehem. When the Torah wants to delineate the things that you should not do and the ways in which you should not be like the indigenous peoples of the land of Canaan, foremost on the list, the thing that God hates, asher sanei, is the way in which they pass their sons and daughters through fire and burn them to their gods. Right? This act is abominable and unthinkable. Okay? So the Torah itself already sets up this difficult space of Avraham being commanded to do something that God in fact describes as being abominable and hateful. The Sifrei Dvarim, an early rabbinic midrash, takes this further and plays out a verse from the book of Yirmiyahu in chapter 19 of that book, which reads as follows.
Uvanu et bamot ha-ba'al lisrof et b'neihem ba'esh olot la-ba'al, asher lo tziviti velo dibarti velo alta al libi.
When Jeremiah here is accusing the people of all of the things that they have done wrong, among what they have done is they've built shrines to the Baal, to the local Canaanite god, and they have on that altar burned their sons in fire as olot, as burnt offerings to the Baal. Ha'alehu sham le'ola, God says to Abraham, offer him up as an ola, a total burnt offering. That is what the people do to the gods of Canaan, about which Yirmiyahu says in the name of God, asher lo tziviti velo dibarti velo alta al libi. I never commanded that, I never said anything of that sort, and it never even occurred to me that you would do such a thing. Based on that pasuk, playing it out, the Sifrei Dvarim reports in the name of Rabbi Yose, in the name of his son, Elazar, that there were three things that he used to say about this verse, asher lo tziviti ba-Torah, velo dibarti ba-aseret ha-dibrot, velo alta al-libi she-yakriv adam et beno agave ha-mizbeach. The first rasha here is to say this three-part phrase, asher lo tziviti, velo dibarti, velo alta al-libi, is to simply emphasize how much this is against what God wants from us. Not only is it not in the Torah, not only is it not in the Ten Commandments, but it is also something God never would have even thought of. Forget about throwing a text at me or its absence. God speaks directly here and says, this is not what I want. And then, developing this even further, in the name of Acherim, other, an unnamed plural group that offers their own midrash, Asher lo tziviti al yiftach, velo dibarti al mesha melech moav, velo alta al libi sheyakriv Avraham beno agabe amizbeach. Here we get in a fascinating midrash, a reference to three instances, or one of them is attempted, of child sacrifice in the Tanakh. We will return to these in greater depth. The first is Yiftach, the shofet, the judge, about whom it's reported in the book of Judges that he sacrifices his daughter. Mesha, the king of Moab, who sacrifices his firstborn son. And bunched up with them is Avraham being commanded to offer his son on the altar, says God through the voice of this midrash, I never commanded nor said anything about, nor did it ever occur to me that anyone would actually go through with such an act. Right? This is sort of, I think, where we come to this, not just as decent human beings, but also as rabbinic Jews. We come stepping out of the text of Dvarim and Sifrei Dvarim to a place of child sacrifice being an abomination and something that we cannot possibly understand how God could have commanded Abraham to do. All right? So that really is the crux of the problem here. It is virtually impossible on that level to reconcile the centrality of the Akedah with what seems to be both our kind of instinctive revulsion to that, as well as what even seems to be the trail of text itself in talking about and reflecting on that kind of action. So the question then is, of course, what do we do with that? Right? And the question of how we deal with that is wrapped up in solving two problems. Right? First is the philosophical problem, which is, how can I live in a space where what I know is good and right stands in conflict with a core narrative? That's piece one. The second piece, which we'll see, is also a problem for many of the interpreters we will look at, is this is an exegetical problem as well. Aside from the fact that it feels wrong, there's another problem here, which is, as silent as the Avraham of the Akedah is, the Avraham who stands before God when the city of Sodom is being threatened to be destroyed is as vocal as the later Avraham is silent. That Avraham comes to God and says, Hashofet kol ha'aretz lo yaseh mishpat, how is it possible that the judge of the whole world will not do justice? How can that man somehow be the same man who goes through silently the motions of the Akedah until seemingly forcibly an angel almost grabs his hand, Al tishlach yadcha el ha'na'ar v'al ta'as lo ve'uma, do not do anything to this child which you are prepared to kill. Right? That those two problems, the philosophical and the exegetical problem, are going to be something that everyone is going to have to deal with. Now, there's two solutions to this that I want to take off the table right from the start that we're not going to be dealing with. The first is, one solution is, you delete the Akedah. Okay? And by delete, I mean, you erase it out of the Sefer Torah, you change that bracha in the Amidah, you change the second day of Rosh Hashanah Torah reading, or some combination thereof. You simply excise it. You take it out of your liturgical expression, and you eliminate it from Jewish experience. Right? I take that off the table because, to my knowledge, no one has actually been willing to do that. Right? No one has felt it is possible that that is actually a viable solution to completely run away from and ignore this text. To the extent you know of a community that's done it, I'm very interested to hear. But for the most part, that doesn't seem like a viable option. And even were you to do it, it of course is just to run away from the problem and not to solve it. If the problem is, how can I deal with a core narrative that's contraindicated by both Avraham's character elsewhere and my own feeling about what is ethical and moral, I haven't solved it by simply ignoring and deleting one of the pieces. Another popular response to it, which I also want to take off the table in the sense of I want to argue against it as the only way of dealing with it, is the common articulation, I even heard this from some of you in sort of the lead up to talking about this series, of saying that Avraham failed the test. But the way we understand this and we deal with it is that actually the Akedah is a tragic story of a great man who blew it. At the end of his life, he ultimately was not able to make the right decision. The reason I want to take that off the table is, while that is a possible reading that one can have of the Torah itself, and a way certainly you can sit in shul on the second day of Rosh Hashanah and experience the Torah reading, it does not in any meaningful way work either with the liturgical expressions we have around the Akedah, which hold up the Akedah not as a failure, but as a great success. It does not in any way really explain or address the ways in which historically the Akedah has served as an incredible, powerful, motivating force for Jews in all kinds of times and places. This reached its climax in the Crusades when the self description of what Jews understood themselves to be going through in the Crusades was a kind of reenactment of the Akedah. And our Slichot, leading up to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, every morning are full of various poems, one of which every day is called an Akedah. Right? The notion that this narrative is somehow simply a story about an error, a failure, I think also it's tantamount to deleting it from the liturgy in terms of the way that it's actually been used. So I think we need to find a different way of dealing with it. And I want to set up a number of different possibilities, two that I want us to consider and understand, but ultimately consider them as falling short, and ultimately to present a third that will be the way I will suggest is the most productive and important for us to move forward with. Yes, comments and thoughts. Okay, though, the difference in all those cases that you raised, correct. In none of those cases does God actually say, do this thing.
Right, but you have other examples, let's say, David HaMelech with Bathsheba and the child died. And clearly, like, this is the bad thing that you did and this is going to be the result. You do have other examples of people kind of taking the law into their own hands, Akadopak, for whatever reason, and it's rewarded by, like, David HaMelech, the Mashiach, and then other times where...
Okay, but I think we have to make a clear distinction between, right, the difference between legislation and enforcement is significant, right? It's one thing to not enforce a law or to decide to haphazardly respond to transgressions of a law or to recognize that certain situations are complicated in all sorts of ways and the benefits might outweigh the risks, etc. It's a whole other level to actually legislate or command something. Right? And also in a lot of the cases that you talked about, some yes, some no, but not all of them, I would say, qualify as, for instance, marrying a Moabite woman. I don't think anyone would put that in the category of that violates fundamental ethical or moral principles. It maybe violates some notion of some kind of social code, some sort of boundary. That doesn't mean it's not very important, but I'm not sure it's of the same character of what animates people about finding this to be a major problem. By the way, maybe you're also inviting me to say what I think is important to say at the beginning. If you're not bothered by the Akedah, great. I don't want to take that away from you. Right? Like, fantastic. You can take a nap. There's some nice books over here on the shelf. Like, this is based on the premise, and I do mean that seriously in the sense it's based on the premise. Our departure point is that one is experiencing that in some way. To the extent one is it, I'm actually not problematizing that. Right? In a way, I'm going to try to end up at that very place where I would like as many of us to be able to leave the room tonight with at least the beginning, if not having arrived at this point, of being able to embrace the Akedah, of something that actually we can say those piyutim, you can scream that line on Rosh Hashanah as loud as you can and feel at one with it. To the extent you're already there, great. Yeah.
This question of commandments that you're bringing up might be what differentiates Abraham's reaction to Sodom and Gomorrah, which, you know, he's not being commanded to a direct command, maybe explain the silence.
Good. Okay. So the suggestion is, you know, maybe one way you're already getting into the productive work here of how do we reconcile what I'm going to call Abraham 1 and Abraham 2. Maybe the fact that there's a command of Lech Lecha El Eretz Amoriah V'Ha'alehu Sham Le'olah and actually go forward with this makes Abraham think, well, what can I say? Whereas in the story of Sodom, God just says, you know, HaMechaseh Ani Me Avraham Et Asher Ani Oseh, I can't conceal it from him, and then narratively tells him the plan of what's going to happen. To that already Abraham feels maybe there's been an invitation to step in where there's not one here. Good. That's certainly one way. I think that'll be very much in keeping with the first model that we'll see that will try to reconcile those two modes. Okay? Great. Yes, one more comment here. Good. So I think we'll see. Let's see by the end of the evening how much what we've developed potentially helps us with that. I'll offer some thoughts on that when we sort of get to the end. Maybe it has to be treated differently, but perhaps even the mode of us thinking about that will be helpful. This is not necessarily the only place where this kind of dynamic is potentially troubling and engaging. Great. Fantastic. Okay. So let's begin now with the first mode that has sometimes been used, particularly in the modern period, to grapple with this. And that's what I've called here the Akedah as moral surrender. The mode where what you actually say the Akedah is about teaching and conveying the very point that the true service of God in fact entails, at least at certain moments in time, doing things that seem unethical. That's in fact the whole point. The tension that you feel is intended to bring you to a certain kind of religious and spiritual height that will make you able to forego what your normal ethical instinct would tell you. One of the most dramatic playing out of this way of telling the Akedah is played out by Søren Kierkegaard, the Danish philosopher in the 19th century. He lives a very short life, but has a number of very influential works. And particularly in Fear and Trembling, he goes on at length to talk about the notion of a knight of faith, knight with a K, the knight of faith, the one who truly serves God, who is able to kind of reach a post-ethical, post-moral place in serving God. The technical philosophical language that he uses is the teleological suspension of the ethical. You get to the point where the telos, the end point of what it means to serve God, becomes so clear that the normal rules of ethics as they operate in the world are suspended. And that's what the knight of faith comes to understand. In the context of this book, which is mostly dealing with kind of playing out the philosophical implications of that, Kierkegaard has these marvelous narrative retellings of the Akedah at the beginning of the book, kind of as part of the prologue, which capture various aspects of what he thinks is going on here. And I want to read them, one of them to you here, which I think gives you a good sense in dramatic form of how he understood this story. Okay? And I will read it with according drama. All right. And God tempted Abraham and said unto him, take Isaac, thine only son, whom thou lovest, and go to the land Moriah, and sacrifice him there on a mountain, which I shall show thee. It was in the early morning. Abraham arose betimes and had his asses saddled. He departed from his tent and Isaac with him. But Sarah looked out of the window after them until they were out of sight. Silently they rode for 3 days. But on the fourth morning, Abraham said not a word, but lifted up his eyes and beheld Mount Moriah in the distance. He left his servants behind, and leading Isaac by the hand, he approached the mountain. But Abraham said to himself, I shall surely conceal from Isaac whither he is going. He stood still. He laid his hand on Isaac's head to bless him, and Isaac bowed down to receive his blessing. And Abraham's aspect was fatherly. His glance was mild, his speech admonishing. But Isaac understood him not. His soul would not rise to him. He embraced Abraham's knees. He besought him at his feet. He begged for his young life, for his beautiful hopes. He recalled the joy in Abraham's house when he was born. He reminded him of the sorrow and the loneliness that would be after him. Then did Abraham raise up the youth and lead him by his hand, and his words were full of consolation and admonishment. But Isaac understood him not. He ascended Mount Moriah, but Isaac understood him not. Then Abraham averted his face for a moment. But when Isaac looked again, his father's countenance was changed, his glance wild, his aspect terrible. He seized Isaac and threw him to the ground and said, thou foolish lad, believest thou I am thy father? An idol worshipper am I. Believest thou it is God's command? Nay, but my pleasure. Then Isaac trembled and cried out in fear, God in heaven, have pity on me. God of Abraham, show mercy to me. I have no father on earth. Be thou then my father. But Abraham said softly to himself, Father in heaven, I thank thee. Better is it that he believes me in human than that he should lose his faith in thee. Okay. That's a heavy one.
The narrative embellishment here is quite clear. The last line captures it most poignantly, which is, any normal person applying their normal ethical standards who would hear such a command as coming from God would think that God to be a monster. And the only way that Abraham can possibly shield his son from losing faith in God is to displace the command, the action, onto himself. Better he should hate me, because who wouldn't hate a father who was raising his knife to slaughter his son? Then he should turn away from God. Now, what's kind of sort of paradoxical to sick, depending on how you react to this, is you have to remember that for Kierkegaard, despite that, the religious obligation in the moment was for Abraham to do exactly what he did. Right? This is not a retelling of the story that displays Abraham as an ethical monster. It is a retelling of the story that displays the fact of there sometimes being a stark, total trade-off between what it means to serve God on the one hand and to fulfill one's ethical obligation. And Abraham, as the true knight of faith, actually plays that out in this moment, despite the enormous gap between what he knows to be ethically reasonable and right and what he knows God expects of him. Okay? This notion of the Akedah as moral surrender is actually quite strong and dominant in the way that modern Jews have thought about this text, at least a slice of them. The idea that, in fact, yes, the way we reconcile this tension on a philosophical plane is to say that human morality is not the same as divine command. Lo machshavotai machshavotechem. The divine intelligence does not correspond one-to-one to the things that human beings think are of ultimate importance. And when you hear God's voice, part of what you have to do is respond, even at the price of total self-abnegation and negating one's commitment to that which one thinks is bedrock in terms of being good and right. Yeah?
Even if the logic, even if the divine logic had nothing to do with human logic, wouldn't fulfilling this command and killing Isaac negate God's logic of the covenant with Abraham?
Good. Fantastic. So there's actually another text. There's a text in Vayikra Rabbah that imagines exactly that, which actually begins to actually put words in Abraham's mouth, where he says, but wait a minute, etmol, yesterday, you said to me, ki v'yitzchaki karei lechazara, he's supposed to be my heir, and today you tell me this. By the way, it's a beautiful text, because in the Torah reading cycle, literally that's how we experience it on Rosh Hashanah. We read the line on day one of Kivi Yitzchaki Karei Lechazara, this will be your heir. And then on day two, we read this command. And that represents a different strand, which will more map on to some other things we'll see, that does not necessarily imagine Abraham as being totally unquestioning or totally silent. But for Kierkegaard, yeah, that irrationality, that mystery, only adds to the luster of this moment. It only makes clear what it is, which is I'm surrendering everything I know in order to pursue this relationship through this command. Yeah?
It's been a long time since I read Kierkegaard, but doesn't he also say something like what you see in Vayikra, that Abraham has this promise from God and this command from God, and his faith is so great that he doesn't feel that he needs to reconcile, that he can obey God's command to sacrifice Isaac, and Isaac will also be the way that his generations go forward.
Yeah, so the question is whether when he talks about Abraham not feeling he has to choose, he means that in the way we think of that, let's say, as American moviegoers, of it'll all work out in the end, the way we thought, or he means something more like, I don't know, in some deep fulfillment of the divine mind, somehow that promise will happen. I'm not sure. I don't think that Kierkegaard would have seen what was going on here as Abraham playing a game of chicken with God that he knows he'll win because he has that promise in the back pocket.
No, he's not saying that. He's saying that Abraham's faith is so great that...
I think Abraham's faith is so great, you don't have to think about those things. And it's almost on some level, I don't have to now check my response to this command by figuring out how it completely adds up with everything else I know. Because what it is to be present in that moment is to respond to that command.
This gets played out, I think, very prominently and beautifully in Leibovitz, which is the next source I want to look at, who tries to take on the exegetical problem, which is, so what about the Abraham at Sodom? If there's Abraham 1 and Abraham 2, how do I understand then that Abraham at Sodom did not just hear what God's plan was and submit silently? Let's just read through this text and then come back on this. Leibovitz writes in an essay called Abraham v'Iyov the following. The fear of God possessed by Abraham, the only one to be called faithful, ma'amin, is unlike the fear of God of any other personality in Bereshit. And the distinction only becomes manifest in the context of the Akedah. This fear is identical to love. And indeed, Abraham is the only biblical character described as a lover of God. Ohev Hashem, Zera Abraham Ohavi. When he defends the principle of the people of Sodom, Abraham advances claims based on justice and law and mercy, all human categories, and based on them, he quote-unquote dares to argue with God. However, when his faith was put to the test, he is silenced, even though he could have advanced very strong arguments, not just based on justice, but based on truth itself. And now he quotes Vayikra Rabbah. He could have said, yesterday you told me that Yitzhak will be your genealogical line, and now you tell me to slaughter him? And yet he said nothing. Abraham's silence demonstrates that his faith is not a conditional faith and is not limited by the limitations of human morality. In other words, Leibovitz's response to the exegetical dilemma is, if I think about Abraham 1 and Abraham 2, the relationship between them is one of a person walking up an ascending staircase of relationship. Abraham 1 is an immature prophet. He is someone who can only articulate things in his own terms, his own human conceptions of justice and morality, and he has not yet come to the point where he's truly in love with God. Because when you are truly in love with someone, and you truly have a relationship with them, you will do things for them that make no sense to you whatsoever. I will never understand why 5 minutes after we pull out of the house, my wife needs to pull over to get a cup of coffee on the way of a long road trip. I don't drink coffee in the morning. I don't understand it. In the early immature years of our relationship, I used to fight back about that. As our relationship has deepened and grown, I now understand that's just part of what it is for us to be partners and to be together. Leibovitz says the same thing about Abraham. The human being bringing human terms as the basis for into the divine human relationship is fundamentally not to have fully embraced the God side of that relationship. What we see in Abraham 2 is Abraham essentially, when confronted with the command to sacrifice his son, says, yes, dear. And that shows that he is Abraham Ohavi, Abraham who loves. That is Leibovitz's model of dealing with the exegetical piece. The moral surrender is a surrender of a self-righteous human reference point of morality in favor of the sort of broad, capacious, transcendent framework that God brings to the table. Okay. Yes. Yeah, I mean, primarily it is achieving faith through obedience to God. Through you're fulfilling that relationship in a deep way. The end goal is faith. Right? That is actually what it means. What it means to be a knight of faith is you've made the leap and you're there.
So is the faith not also the material which allows the knight to suspend political?
Meaning?
To overcome
At that moment where he's suspending his ethical judgment?
Yeah, when did he get there?
Yeah, well, he seems to, in this narrative, get there when he's willing to do it, right? He apparently didn't have to do it. I didn't actually have to go through it for God to then say, Atayadati, right now I know that you're my faithful servant. So there's some sort of inner transition, it seems to be, where the person, they let go. They're willing to do it. At that point, the other person on the other side of the relationship can decide to rescind the request, right? But you can't be waiting necessarily for that to happen or checking it against your own.
I don't see that as a resolution of the conflict between faith and the ethics yet.
Okay, because ultimately all we've done is chosen. This is the opposite of erasing the passage from the Sefer Torah. We have just erased a part of ourselves. Okay? Good. Good. Correct. What are the limits? At what point? Well, let's even translate that into relationships, into language we would use today about that, right? We're all for loving relationships. At a certain point, relationships can become abusive. Right? At a certain point, someone can ask or demand something from you that you can't say back, well, if you loved me enough, you would do this. No, the fact that you're putting this forward as the acid test of my love shows that there's something problematic. Yeah.
Yeah, and with respect to the king of polytheism, labeled it, I mean, he makes these jumps. Sh'eni Yirat Hashem Shel Abraham says, oh, on what basis? You know, he defines some new idea of Yirah beyond fear. Yirah is Yirah, number one. Number two, Zera Abraham Wabi. Let's be clear. Zera, not Abraham. Zera Abraham. Which, I think, we missed that little part.
Okay.
Pretty shaky ground with this whole story.
Okay, okay. Any other, yeah, Leibovitz bashers?
Well, as you said, the mature Abraham has moved beyond thinking we need human moral capacity. This sacrificing his son is not a human moral category, it's a divine moral category. It's in very anti-civilization one. So,
say more what you mean.
And then he's not just defying human moral standards, he's defying a divine moral standard.
Okay, so right. This is the problem of how we cross-reference Dvarim and Bereishit. I'll come back to that. I would say it's fair to say Leibovitz probably would say something like, Dvarim says that as sort of the normal rule or normal way this plays out. But in this moment, I wanted you to do something different, right? And that goes to the question of what does it mean to hear the voice of God through a text as opposed to directly, and how does one tell the difference between those two, and how does one even know when one of them is God speaking now as opposed to at another time more generally? That's not necessarily cleaned up. Yeah, two more comments here. Yeah, more.
I don't necessarily see them as being like Avram 1 and Avram 2 as a stage of maturation. I think it's two different types of challenges. You know, his faith wasn't challenged by Sodom, right? He just said, this is what I want to do. And Avram said, well, it doesn't really seem right to me based on my context. And God said, I'm doing it, and fine, that was it. But here, I think there seems to be something much more existential about saying, I told you that you have perfect faith in convincing that. And now I'm telling you something completely different, where essentially there's a challenge of faith. I think to me, it's like that's the point, that is that he's willing to get beyond, you know, an existential challenge of faith rather than just kind of method of interpretation.
But what about the fundamental conflict in terms of the question of killing the innocent? Right, the charge that he levels at God at Sodom, and let's point out, I think it's fair to say, right, it's not a suggestion by Abraham. Right? I mean, he's very deferential and obsequious, but Hashofei kol haaretz lo yaaseh mishpat, chalila lecha. How do you do that? Right? The charge there is killing innocent people. Why I understand there's a sort of existential development and his own narrative that is very different than the Akedah piece. But isn't the innocent boy who's about to have his neck slit the same basic moral problem?
Not really, because it's a complete contradiction of earlier comments.
Okay, so you want to say, Davka, the fact that he holds in his memory something that is a complete contrast to what's happening now makes the whole thing almost just more of a blur to him. In a way, it's not sort of like I came across and now God suddenly saying, I'm going to kill this innocent person. It's something's weird here anyway, which is God told me this person's going to be my heir and now is telling me to kill. I don't know. It's almost like I'm in some, one of those like blindfolded trust games, right? Where you're sort of going along and people are asking you to do crazy things, but the whole premise is we're working out some relationship of trust. All right, that's interesting. So that would be a relation. That would be a reading of Leibovitz as saying, therefore, it is specifically appropriate in this context. I think there still feels like, even if you don't see there as being sort of a narrative, there is still a hierarchy in Leibovitz. It's very clear that being able to get to a point of not worrying about those human categories is a higher place than worrying about them. Right? That I think is pretty clear. Yeah.
So it seems to me that a lot of our problems with this text and the story of the Exodus stem from us trying to put ourselves into the shoes of Avraham and try and parse what he's thinking at that moment and how he's dealing with the moral challenge and how he can be the same Avraham who earlier was so objecting to God's unethical sort of course of action. I want to say two things. One is, first of all, that it's a Akedat Yitzchak, and are we somehow missing some of the point here by failing to focus on Yitzchak's story in this, which is actually the one that is in our liturgy. When we recall Akedat Yitzchak, and when in the Crusades, Jews embraced the experience of the Akedat, they were embracing Yitzchak.
The victimhood.
Right, not Abraham so much. So, but bragging that for a moment, this is a symbolic story. I mean, it's meant for us to experience as observers, right? In other words, we're not meant to be Abraham. We're meant to learn some lessons from the way the story is constructed. So, it's almost like it's a drama. You know, do you really believe the play within the play in Shakespeare? Do you really believe... No, Shakespeare's creating a condition which allows you as an audience to say, to make something plausible. Same thing's going on here, right? Abraham... God tells Avram, go slaughter Yitzchak, and then at the last moment says, do not, not. And we can draw from that the idea that God doesn't actually act in such immoral ways, even when it appears he does, and that there is hope for a last-minute reversal. And, it's almost like we're questioning the premise of a fable.
Okay, so first of all, that's for sure a way you could read the Akedah. I want to say just two things about it. One, that is challenged by the Torah's function as a hyper-normative text in Jewish life, including, right, since the Ramban takes on the first Rashi in Sefer Torah, in Sefer Bereshit, of saying that, and the point of all those patriarchal narratives is for us to learn by example all sorts of things. So while it's possible you could read it that way, there's a lot of water under the bridge of not. Second, specifically, I would say, and here's where, you might fairly depart from any number of modern readings of the Akedah in this regard. But Davka, for instance, why does Leibovitz care about this? Right? Leibovitz cares about this reading of the Akedah in part because he is deeply invested in a contemporary theory of Jewish behavior and fidelity to halacha that is about simply following what the regulations that are on the books are, without getting overly into all kinds of instinctive human categories as to what should play out. And he's worried about avoiding all kinds of extremism. He's worried about devolving into certain kinds of secularity of various forms in the modern world. He's also worried about things like people, worshipping the Kotel HaMaravi, and he wants to find some way of saying no, right? The famous statement in this regard is it's basically like reading the phone book, right? I mean, that's what it is. You open up the Shulchan Aruch, and it's not supposed to mean anything. It's just a discipline manual. That's it, right? So, even if one could read it otherwise, part of what's at stake with these different readings of the Akedah is ultimately, how do we think this translates into our lives? All right, now we've got to move on to the next model here. I want to just say this, which is, I want you to feel, before you totally leave him behind, I hope you feel some of the power and compelling nature of Kierkegaard and Leibovitz, if only from the language of relationship that is used, and the ways in which that captures something powerful. Because even if
It's only to understand why this has been so compelling to so many people, and particularly in the context of a modernity that has often, particularly in the 20th century, scarred Jews in terms of not knowing exactly whether the world is a reliable place in terms of its moral and ethical instincts or not, right? Certainly to certain post-Shoah thinkers, the notion that the Akedah represents a certain clear lodestar, that the Torah is this sort of ethical or this religious lodestar that is ultimately exempt from all the vicissitudes of changing human, moral, ethical dynamics, that there's something very powerful and attractive about that, right? Particularly in the American Jewish scene, Rav Soloveitchik and his students, many have been exemplars of this view to the hilt. Like, a lot of the kind of philosophical background of most of modern Orthodoxy has been about submission to the higher will of God, submission of the ethical to the larger service of the divine. All right? And there's something very powerful about that. I don't think I need to belabor too much the ways in which it is also very dangerous and very problematic. Right? Aside from the fact that for many of you it probably just instinctively feels horrible, to sort of unpack a little more what that's about, the fundamental problem, of course, is that at the end of the day, if you're a human being and you have human points of reference, to cast God as being different of, in conflict with, ethical and moral norms is essentially to say, in more pious language, that God, as defined in human terms, is unethical and immoral. Right? You actually can't get around that. You can talk about suspending and saying, well, the human terms aren't relevant, but you're acknowledging that were I to describe the God of Har HaMoriah in human ethical terms, I would say, this person is a monster, which is exactly what Kierkegaard does. Right? That's what he captures in that brilliant retelling, which is that, yes, Yitzhak, Dafka, from his perspective, anyone who would see this play out and would think it's coming from God, he would think God's a monster. I already, says Avraham, I have 100 years under my belt with this character. I have enough stability here, I can pull it off. But Yitzhak, who make him whatever age you want to make him at that point, but is less ripe in his relationship with God, he'll turn away. And actually there lies the seed of the problem with any formulation that talks about the Akedah as moral surrender. Because for the most part, the way we operate as human beings is when there are figures, beings, governments who control us and force and demand of us to do things that we find to be abhorrent, for the most part, the first moment that we get the political power to free ourselves from those tyrants, we do so. And therefore, from a religious perspective, there is a danger with this model of moral surrender, irrespective of whether it is the correct description of God. It may actually lead in the long term to more apostasy, to more departure from divine commands, because people in a free and open world will not really ultimately submit themselves to things that they are not willing in some way to self-author as being consonant with their own commitment. And that's another thing I think is very important, which who knows? Also, Leibovitz, writes this when he writes it. He didn't pass away that long ago. But if he were considering the question afresh today, and with all the degrees of freedom that contemporary society affords, I don't know whether he might not have revisited some of that. Okay? I want to move us to the next. I promise I'll keep some time at the end of the next section, but I want us now to see why someone would therefore move to another place. And here to feature a second model, which is that of Rabbi David Hartman. Hartman engages the Kierkegaard, Leibovitz, Soloveitchik mode of thinking about the Akedah and takes it on directly for the reasons we said. And in A Heart of Many Rooms, he offers one of his formulations of this point. He says, on the bottom of page 2, the God of Abraham, therefore, takes two very different forms in the book of Genesis. A God who demands total surrender to his command, the God Abraham encounters at the Akedah, and a God who invites independent moral critique and judgment, the God Abraham encounters at Sodom. These two paradigms have informed religious life as well as interpretation and exegesis throughout Jewish history. For many teachers from the time of the Talmud to the modern period, including Yeshayahu Leibovitz and my own teacher, Rabbi Joseph E. Soloveitchik, the Akedah, the binding of Isaac, was the dominant paradigm of religious life and thought.
For them, the survival and continuity of the tradition require the unconditional surrender and loyalty that the Akedah represents. To be claimed by God, I must be willing to sacrifice my intellect and intuition, to give up everything I know and cherish as a human being in deference and obedience to the Word of God. Contemporary critiques of those who appeal to moral considerations and questions of religious practice and change often invoke an Akedah mode of reasoning, arguing or implicitly presupposing that religious life would lose all credibility if submission and surrender were any less than total. The belief that if you change anything, everything will collapse owes its logic and conviction to the silence of Abraham in the Binding of Isaac story. Yet, Abraham, in pleading for Sodom, felt that God was not beyond his own understanding of moral argument and persuasion. This other paradigm, therefore, says, bring your moral intuitions, your subjective sense of dignity and justice into your understanding of the reality of God. Not only does it not threaten or undermine religious consciousness, but it is actually necessary for recognizing the validity and applicability of the divine command. In other words, Hartman has a very different model, where Abraham 1 and Abraham 2 are two dueling modes that fundamentally together make up a kind of balanced diet, balanced theological diet of how we relate to God on questions of ethics. Sometimes we do need a God of surrender, says Hartman, but that God, in Hartman's estimation, has been overestimated. That Abraham has been built up to be too large and has shouted down Abraham 1. And Hartman's project is to restore Abraham 1, not as an immature voice, not as a lower level of serving God, but as another mode. Here, Morty, I would say he adopts very clearly your language, but in a different way of, these are two different kinds of modes for two different challenges, and what the Jew is supposed to recognize is, sometimes we have to really bring our challenges, our critiques, our own perspectives to the engagement with God and God's commands, and sometimes we'll have to realize that at the end of the day, we have to throw our hands up and say, I don't get it, and submit. Okay? But Hartman's response is to say, the Abraham II obsessed reading of the Akedah is excessive. And we need, therefore, to restore the voice of Abraham I to have a saner and more balanced picture. The Abraham at Sodom is of equal and opposing weight to the Abraham at Har HaMoriah. Okay. Yes. Good. So that's really ultimately where I want to get to in a third model of potentially thinking about it that way. For now, I think it's important to note, Hartman would concede. Okay, this is what's important to understand about Hartman. Hartman is a response and a polemic against Leibowitz and Kierkegaard, but he concedes that Abraham II is a separate character from Abraham I, and Abraham II, in fact, when he sacrifices his son, is doing something that is contraindicated by human ethical norms. In that moment, he is surrendering. However, Hartman says the mistake is not really that. The mistake is to think that that's the only mode in which we engage with God. Sometimes we hear God issuing command and we say, that can't be right. You got to rethink this. Okay? But it still exists for him as a mode that is about suspending that ethical peace. Yeah.
To what degree is the emphasis on Abraham at the Akedah influenced by the actual stories themselves? Because at the end of the Akedah, Abraham is rewarded, essentially, and held up as a paragon of what you should be doing, right? But the stone story ends in a very ambiguous discussion, where it's not clear what's going to happen. And then there's no story afterwards. It turns out there were good people at Stone who were saved because of Abraham. They're all bad. Even Lot and his daughters were saved, engage in horrific behavior. And I wonder if that the emphasis on the on these Abraham at Stone is because the story doesn't really back up any reward or any great result based on Abraham's interference.
You want to say that's guiding Hartman's analysis?
Yeah, that's guiding, or perhaps that's just building up that why should we emphasize the Akedah story so much? Because the Torah doesn't emphasize a good result from the Sodom story.
Okay, good. Meaning you're responding to, in a way, you could say, it's not necessarily what Leibovitz's counterpoint would be, but one of the counterpoints you're essentially saying is, these two aren't really equal.
Yeah.
Come on. This is clearly a climax compared to this. And it's interesting to point out that you say the narrative, it's not even like the text ends with, right? If Hartman were to write the Torah in the ideal way for it to come out for him, it should have ended with Abraham saying to God, Ataya Dati, now I know that you are a moral and ethical God because you listened to me. Right? And there's not actually that mirror image conclusion there. It's left in much more of a muddle. Great. Okay, good. That's another one of the issues. Yeah.
If we had more time, I think it would be interesting to explore an Abraham that exists before Abraham 1 and 2. And that is the Abraham who listens to a human command putting two people, Hagar and Ishmael, at the risk of death.
Mm-hmm.
Sending them into the desert.
Great. We can go back even further. The Midrash plays this out further, which is, how about the command of Lech Lecha Me'aretzcha Mimoladetcha Mibeit Avicha? What does it mean to leave your aging father behind? And there's a Midrash that actually says, Parsha Noach ends with Vayamot Terach Becharah. Terach, his father, dies. And then, the way you read it is, he died, then he got the command. And Beit Avicha means, like, his father was dead, but his ancestral home. But if you do the math, the Midrash realizes, Terach was alive for like 80 years after that. Right? And it says, why did it preempt the announcement of Terach's death before Abraham's departure? So you wouldn't think bad of him for leaving his father. Right? So there's other moments that we could actually potentially point to where there's other kinds of conflicts. I think what's powerful about this particular dyad is they both involve the killing of an innocent person. Right, so it's not that they're the only places where this plays out, but those other ones, right, even chasing Hagar and Ishmael out of the house, it's like, maybe it's killing, via grama, indirectly, right? There's a sort of like, you may know they're going to die, but it's not the same as the lightning bolt coming down and killing the people of Sodom, or the knife coming to slit Yitzchak's neck, right? And that's what I think makes them attractive as a contrast. But I think you're right. They're not necessarily the only episodes we could look at. Okay? Okay, good. Hartman, I think, I think it's obvious here, has a sort of subtlety and a complexity and a multivocality that makes it attractive in all kinds of ways. The limit here is essentially what I already said, which is to the extent that there is a problem with positing a God who commands you to do something that you understand to be completely and totally unethical, that's kind of a problem if it ever happens. Not a problem if it only happens 50% of the time. Right? So, in a way, Hartman has kind of made it more palatable, has given more voice, allows you, as he indicates, he's trying to sort of push back people who will say, you can never bring any concern to any conversation about halakha or Jewish behavior. No, I can. I can revive Abraham and Sodom. But Hartman doesn't really address the theological crux that we started with, which is, how could God ever tell me to do that in the first place? Right? Even once is too much. So the question is then, is there a way of actually moving beyond these two models to any other way where you can actually embrace the Akedah, read it on the second day of Rosh Hashanah, shout it out in the Amidah, but nonetheless still be at one with one's ethical development? Obviously, I think there is. And I want to look at that in this section that I've called Recapturing the Ethical Avraham. And this draws inspiration from, really, a point made in a small essay by Robert Gordas in Judaism decades ago, back in 1976, where he says very clearly that everyone has gotten this all wrong because what they have done is projected onto the ancient world assumptions that were completely different than theirs were. When the Akedah narrative is read in the larger context of the book of Genesis, Gordas writes, it offers no support for the doctrine of the teleological suspension of the ethical. Just four chapters earlier, When God reveals his decision to destroy the sinful cities of Sodom and Amorah, Abraham does not hesitate to dispute the decision. Here, there is no hint of submission by the knight of faith to the incomprehensible will of God. Abraham feels that God's decision is in violation of the ethical law, and he expresses his unshakable conviction that God cannot violate the principles of righteousness. Hashofet kol haaretz lo yaseh mishpat. How then can Abraham himself have submitted to an active violation of the ethical law? In view of Abraham's ringing affirmation of the binding character of the moral law, how is this uncomplaining acceptance of God's command to sacrifice his son to be understood? Before we even get to the next paragraph, what is Gordas saying? Abraham 1 is Abraham 2. This is the same person. And therefore, anything you think about Abraham 2 has to be constrained by what you know about Abraham 1. This is not a progression from an immature prophet to a mature one. This is not a bipolar personality figuring out how he's going to interact with God today. This is one person with one integral sense of religious duty and ethical commitment coming to two different circumstances. So you better have a narrative reading of Abraham 2 that makes him entirely identical with Abraham 1. And what allows that? An insight as to what the actual role of child sacrifice would have been in the world that Abraham inhabited. And this is the part that is difficult and strange for us to accept, but I think indisputably true. To be sure, offering up one's child was an infinitely more painful gift to one's God than sacrificing the firstborn of one's cattle or the tithing of one's crops. Abraham was being subjected to the most painful test possible, but he was not being asked to violate the moral law as he understood it. In other words, says Gordas, Abraham would have looked at you like you were insane if you had told him, "Oh my God, God just commanded you to murder your son." The same way that a parent who was sending their child off to fight in a war that they deeply believed in as a just cause would look at you like you were insane if you said to them, "You are now about to murder your child." It would have been the most difficult thing Abraham was ever asked to do. And in that sense, it was beyond all belief that he was willing to do it. But in the sense that the things that we know ultimately are right and have value, but are excruciatingly difficult, are hard for us, but that we do not see as being unethical. Murder of an innocent child in Abraham's world would have been unthinkable and immoral and unethical, but the sacrifice of a firstborn son to a God to whom you've devoted your life, in Abraham's perspective, would not have been ethically abhorrent. Now, let's just play this out a little, and then we can jump all over it, okay? If you actually start to look at the Tanakh through this eyes, hold Dvarim in abeyance for a minute. If you look at the Tanakh through this, you actually realize that this is lurking there in a lot more places than you might think. In a very striking way, the formulation in Shmot, Meleatcha v'dimacha lo te'acher, b'chor banecha titen li. Bring me the fullness of your harvest, the outflow of your presses, and give me your firstborn son. How about the next line? Kein ta'aseh l'shorcha l'tzonecha. Give me, so you should do for your ox and for your sheep, shivat yamim yihyeh imimo, bayom hashmini titno li. 7 days it should be with the mother, on the eighth day, give him to me. Now we read this text, and I'm not saying that Shmot already is not intended to be read this way, as when it says, Bechor banecha titen li, it means, give him to me to serve in the Beit HaMikdash, or we read it as, have a ceremony with some guy whose last name is Kagan and exchange a $5 silver piece, okay? That's what titen li, give me your firstborn son, is. And then we just jump to, with the animal, it means sacrifice him. Okay? Even if that split is already there, I'm not claiming the plain sense of Shmot Kaf Bet Kaf Chet is you must sacrifice your firstborn son, but the ability to use the same verb and formulation clearly indicates a cultural backdrop where those two acts are not considered to be dramatically different. further. Let's go back to that midrash at the beginning. Remember those characters, Yiftach and Meshach? Well, when we actually look at the narratives in the Tanakh, it's not so clear that as far as the Tanakh is concerned, something abominable or unimaginable has happened. The story of Yiftach, which we won't read here in great depth, but you should look at it in greater depth afterwards on your own, talks about the tragic case of Yiftach, the judge, as he goes out to war against Ammon, promising that if God delivers him victory, he will offer up as a sacrifice the first thing that comes out of his house. And when he comes home, look in verse 34, Yiftach came to Mitzpah into his house, and behold, his daughter came out to meet him, with timbrels and with dances, and she was his only child. Besides her, he had neither son nor daughter. And it came to pass, when he saw her, he rent his clothes and said, "Alas, my daughter, you have brought me very low. You have become my troubler, for I have opened my mouth unto the Lord, and I cannot go back." And she said unto him, not, "What are you, crazy? You're going to do this unethical, monstrous, terrible thing?" She did not run away. She did not fight. She said unto him, "My father, thou hast opened thy mouth unto the Lord. Do unto me according to that which hath proceeded out of thy mouth. For as much as the Lord hath taken vengeance for you of your enemies, even of the children of Ammon." And then she asked for a 2-month reprieve to bemoan the fact that she's being taken at such a young age. Verse 39, it came to pass at the end of 2 months she returned to her father, who did with her according to his vow which he had vowed, and she had not known a man. And it was a custom in Israel that the daughters of Israel went yearly to lament the daughter of Yiftach the Gileadite 4 days in a year. When Chazal come along and offer a midrash about this, they are horrified that Yiftach did not release the vow. Concept probably unknown to anyone living in the time of Tanakh, but they cannot imagine that someone confronted with actually killing their kid would not find a way to get out of it. Not at all clear that Pshuto Shel Mikra, what the Tanakh is concerned about here, has anything to do with that. The daughter is not perturbed by it. I am not sure at all that the narrator is perturbed by it. To the extent the narrator is perturbed by Yiftach, it's that he is an idiot. It's that he is rash. It is that he is a kind of impetuous force who will say things that will lead him to make insane sacrifices that he didn't need to. Because again, even if it's not ethically unconscionable to sacrifice your daughter, you don't go signing up for that at the Chinese auction, right? This is not something you elect to do. This is something that maybe is foisted upon you. The problem with Yiftach is that he's a boor, but not necessarily that he's a monster. And to reinforce that further, the story of Meshach seems to say the same thing, and to go even further. This is a battle between Yisrael and Moab, and when the king of Moab saw that the battle was too sore for him, he took with him 700 men that drew sword to break through unto the king of Edom, but they could not. Right? This is like the Alamo for Moab. They're totally trapped. They try to get out. They can't get anywhere. The last, when all hope was lost, he took his eldest son that should have reigned in his stead and offered him for a burnt offering upon the wall. Vaya'alehu ola, the exact same language. And there came great wrath upon Israel, and they departed from him and returned to their own land. Not only does Meshach sacrifice his firstborn son, it works. It repels the Israelite offensive. In the world of the Tanakh, seemingly as pictured here, this is a very painful, incredible sacrifice, but on some level, the ultimate valor of this sacrifice is such that the Israelite offense, the good guys, are repelled. And Micha, the language of our own prophet in this regard, is very striking. B'me'a kadem Adonai ikaf l'Elohei marom. Ha'kadmenu ve'olot ba'galim b'nei shana. How shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before God on high? Shall I come before God with burnt offerings, with calves of a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with tens of thousands of rivers of oil, and without missing a beat? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? Ha'etein b'chori pish'i pri vitni chatat nafshi. In the language of the world of the Tanakh,
one of the things that you do as an ultimate sacrifice sometimes is sacrifice your child. Now, how do we reconcile that with Dvarim? Okay? There's one of two ways of reconciling with Dvarim. One is, this would be the more radical reading, which I'm not sure I would sign up for, which is that Dvarim is actually only bothered by that act because they burned those children for foreign gods.
Say it again?
They burned those children for foreign gods. But it's not actually commenting about doing that in the presence of some authentic divine command to do that. Okay? Them doing it on their own volition, maybe that's all the verse is talking about. The reason I don't love it is the language of Lo ta'aseh chein l'Hashem Elokecha sounds like the practices that are being described shouldn't be done in the Israelite cult either. The less radical reading would be to say that, yes, Dvarim is against child sacrifice. But that says very little about whether Avraham would have heard the command by God to do it to be something unimaginable. That is to say, Dvarim is legislating, trying to move the needle in a world that thinks of child sacrifice as something of great pain, but ethically responsible that a person does, and move that world to one that finds it reprehensible. Maybe even the bottom line of the Akedah is through that process Abraham himself is supposed to learn that maybe I don't really want child sacrifice. But even that I'm not wedded to. I'm not sure that the Abraham story doesn't end where it began. And in Dvarim we have the articulation of the legislation of the moral persuasion to actually begin to change that world, which ultimately succeeds in great crowning triumph in the Sifrei Dvarim, where Chazal can look back at the Torah and say, "Asher lo tziviti velo dibarti velo alta libi," we never ever imagined that child sacrifice was possible, even in the days of Abraham. But to read back anachronistically the Sifrei's conclusion at the end of that journey into what Abraham already was supposed to know, and thereby create a kind of Kierkegaardian monster of a figure who hears an unethical command, nonetheless is willing to do it, and then hold that up as the paradigm for true religious service for God, that I think is a step too far, and one that is not actually necessary to take. Where Gordas, I think, potentially brings us to is to a place where you can then own the Akedah. Because what you can say is, what I am talking about in my tefillot, in that Torah reading, is what it means in one's context, in one's world, to be asked to do some of the most ultimate, difficult things in the name of a cause that one believes in and one knows is true. We all have things that we deeply believe in, but we're also not so sure whether we fully have the courage to sign up for them. The Akedah is the call of saying, yes, the ultimate in Jewish devotion is to be prepared to go that mile. But by making the translation from their world to ours, as Gordas calls on us to do, and to recognize that, but it may be that part of the way the story has played out around child sacrifice specifically means that now, in our world, lo tziviti lo dibarti lo alta libi, God would never, ever today ask anyone to sacrifice their kid. Okay, now we have space for just open questions. I'll take a bunch in a row to try to just gather them. Yeah. Human morality.
Great. Okay, good. I'm gonna take a bunch and I'll come respond to that. Yeah. So then you're like, well, what? That's
well,
not
you
so
know,
impressive.
Who cares?
Okay,
story,
come back
to that
too. Great.
Yeah, comment then a question. I believe that David Hartman actually does choose Abraham 1 over Abraham 2. It's a very difficult separation with his teacher. And that is,
right.
Whether it's here or elsewhere, he actually is not prepared to sacrifice moral intuition, which leads me to the second question, and that is the relationship of divine command in our time, which I might translate as halakha, which is what we've got, and the role of moral intuition if we don't have the opportunity to engage in conversation, as Abraham did at Sebastian Moros, to engage in direct conversation with God, which is what is correct.
Okay, great. Let me take that little batch, and then we'll hopefully have time for a couple more. So I want to really push back on what you just said, of why it's still a big deal. Okay? And I actually think feeling that it's not a big deal unless it subjects us to doing something that is horribly unethical is actually part of the malady that we need to cure in our contemporary thinking about the Akedah as a model and religious service bichlal. The notion that something is, and I would just even to clarify and go further, my answer to the question of was Abraham asked to sacrifice his ethics is, of course not. Okay? Not just maybe not, of course not. Okay? And that comes from a place of, well, that's due to all the kind of critiques and issues that we already talked about. But specifically, why is it still a big deal? The same reason, and this is how I'll also come to your point, the same reason that someone sending a child into battle is still a really big deal. The same reason that someone liquidating all of their possessions in order to move halfway across the globe to do something is a very big deal. The way in which someone would give away, you know, almost all of their money to tzedakah is a really big deal. There are all sorts of things that are actually very, very hard, that are very difficult, that actually most of us don't have it within us to do, but we deeply admire and on some level aspire to be like the people who actually do them and pull them off, right? And here I would say we have to be careful not to confuse the taming of the id with the overriding of the superego, right? The notion, taming the id is not easy. Just sort of doing what I feel like doing and what's most comfortable is the natural thing most of us would do if we didn't find a way to often say, well, this would be the most convenient thing to do, but it's not the right thing to do. That is very hard work, which does not need to entail us saying that the ultimate service to a higher power is that I thought I was going to do the right thing here, but I have to actually sort of, you know, self-abnegate and find a way to move away from that. So I actually think that in a way, I mean, I worry sometimes that actually when we hold up this sort of subversion of a kind of deepest ethical and moral instincts as the only way that we serve God, we can actually cloud the ways in which most of the work of halakha, of serving God, of all the ways we might use that language, is actually about how do I get myself to do extraordinary things that I think I ought to do, but I'm not necessarily really prepared to do, or I'm scared to do, or I'm not willing to make that sacrifice. I think there are still things, if we were in a world where all that happened was people pushed themselves to doing what Abraham did in his context, in the Akedah, that would be a world of heroism of amazing proportions. And I think that piece is really important here of what does it mean, how does this model not just plunge us back into saying, all right, but Abraham still did something unethical, right? And there I would say we have to be willing to critique ourselves from two directions, right? One is, I'm not so sure that part of our problem with Abraham and thinking that he needlessly killed his kid is that we kind of think sacrificing is a load of bull, right? Meaning, what he would have thought of as a supremely significant act, we think of as the equivalent of flushing money down the toilet, right? The notion that we are alienated from the act itself as supremely worthy. And here's where example, I keep coming back to this example of war and sending people off to war. That's exactly the dividing line of when people are behind the cause of a war, they feel one way very differently than when they are not behind the cause of the war. The same exact action, the same violence, the same danger to life. How much I think what I'm doing is significant as opposed to dying in vain, I think makes all the difference. So one thing I think we have to be careful is we may actually be having a problem with the Akedah, not so much because Abraham is sending his kid to die, but because we can't identify with that as a meaningful action. And that may not be fair to put on Abraham or God or the Torah, etc. The other piece is what I'm alluding to in the other direction, which is to the extent that we do still have circumstances in which we would actually feel comfortable essentially sending people to a near certain death, or at least a high chance of death because of something that we would believe in, then I'm not so sure that we can sit in such a confident place and say, well, actually, the act of, you know, exposing your kid to danger in that way is something that's always unethical. Now, I'll put a critique that you didn't quite articulate, but I thought you were going to go to this, which is something that I still struggle with. Just there's a kind of paradoxical effect of looking at the story this way, which is if you buy Gordas and the basic narrative we've laid out here, you save this whole business. There's no Abraham 1-2. There's one person. There's never an example in the Torah of God commanding something that's unethical. By saying what, though? That ethics has changed over time. Right? So it's not that I necessarily am saying that Abraham did something unethical, but I'm willing to posit that the same exact words said to Abraham then were perfectly fine, and if said today, would be determined to be completely monstrous and unethical. That can paradoxically lead you right back into the arms of Leibowitz, which is to say, if that's the story you're going to tell of how human history plays out, well, then maybe I shouldn't be so sure about my ethical convictions, because then maybe they're going to change again. Okay? To which I would offer two responses to that, which are not intended to dismiss that question, but at least so I've begun to think about it. First is, you know, the story Gordas has told here is a story of something that was innocuous becoming forbidden. Something that was an acceptable part of the world to something that you could never imagine doing that. That does not necessarily imply the reverse process, which is to say, it's not necessarily a critique of Gordas to say that when I feel it would be totally unethical to actively do X thing in the world, I shouldn't be so sure. Maybe I should do it because maybe it will sort of in the future become permitted, and that's the sort of transcendent morality God is pointing us to. I think there is a place to actually think about there being, you know, Tamar Roth has written about this with respect to gender, others have thought about it sort of more broadly about God's unfolding relationship with humanity. Social scientists have talked about this with humanity's unfolding relationship with violence and the ways in which the most violent of societies today is far less violent than most societies were thousands of years ago. I don't think it denies the possibility of some progressive thrust to the story of ethics and morality that, despite little glitches along the way, may nonetheless have a vector to it. The second piece, and this is on some level kind of where I began with some of the critique, is even taking that concern into account, the dynamic that you create in terms of your relationship with God and the kind of plausible durability of functioning as an ethical, moral person in relationship with God is dramatically different, and I would say dramatically more positive and productive, when you adopt the kind of reading that Gordas makes possible than when you go back into the Leibowitz paradigm. Because at the end of the day, in terms of how you will sort of, what your relationship will be with God, like Leibowitz is all about relationship, right? but what your relationship will be with God if God is actually unable to be compatible in some fundamental way with the things that you as a human being have as your baseline of the things that are most instinctively kind of right and good to do. It's a fundamentally dangerous place to be in for that to be in a major, for there to be a gap there. And in that sense, I would say to you, like, even without being sure of exactly how it plays out, the kind of religious world that I would want to live in and the kind of world that ultimately I think the Torah with its characters basically overwhelmingly, I'm arguing exclusively models, is one in which people don't feel that their service to God is somehow in fundamental conflict with what it means to be who they are. It can be in fundamental conflict with what they want to do, but that's very different from being in fundamental conflict with their greatest projection of who they're supposed to be. And I actually think long term, I don't think it's really plausible or viable. On the question of halacha, and how we bring that, I would say, first of all, it's a fair point on Hartman. Like, Hartman in the Heart of Mary Rooms is not really anymore the Hartman of The God Who Ate Flies. It has moved to a really totally different place on this, and I accept that 100%. But I would say, like he begins to say here, yeah, and I've talked about this in other contexts, that, in fact, the whole process of serious engagement of halacha is supposed to be and can be and should be one in which all of those questions of what is this text demanding of me and how is it supposed to shape my character and why is the application of this text to my life bothering me and troubling me and can I find someone else who grapples with that question in the past and can I find halachic language for articulating the ways in which that's complex, that's what that conversation is supposed to be about. It's not supposed to be about the halacha is in some black box. And then there's me with my mishmash of feelings that is totally separated from it. And the only question is, how much do I allow this to crush me or for me to defeat that? Right? It's actually supposed to be about my being in that box with everything that is me and being affected by everything that's in there. And that actually produces, that's what the great tradition, as I understand it, of Psak is all about, is how you live in those conditions, in those realities, with all the things that they bring and how it translates into some plan for action. Two final comments. Yeah.
So how postmodern are we going to be here? Is there such a thing as ethics in this, in the traditional philosophical sense as trying to discover principles that are true for all people at all time, or is it fully culturally determined?
Okay. And yes, to be the last one.
It's actually a very similar question. Just to check. I'm not saying I espouse any needs to think of more broad language, but are you putting Avram on the same level of Noah, who was a good man for his time? Mm-hmm. It's got the same question. Is there something really called time context specific or temporal morality as opposed to
good. Okay. So I will end with a combined response to those two pieces. Lest this sound overly postmodern or overly sort of just trying to relativize anything, and there's no anchor for this, and this is not the way traditional language talks at all, I'll give you one striking example from the tradition that you can think about and that potentially serves as a further anchor for thinking this way. The language here in Dvarim is Lo ta'asechein l'Hashem Elokecha ki kol to'avat Hashem asher saneh asu le'lo'ehem. Okay? The abominations which God has hated, they did. Asher saneh. The phrase asher saneh appears only one other time in the Torah, and it is, anyone know? Torah readers in the group? Lo takim lecha matzeva asher saneh Adonai Elohecha. Don't set up a stone pillar, a monument, which God hates. Any reader of the Torah knows that Yaakov spends most of his life running around setting up stone monuments and dedicating them to God, and there being no one saying boo. And Rashi comments on that pasuk and says, "Asher saneh Hashem Elokecha." See, I was prepared for this question. The af al pi shehayta ahuva lo bimei ha'avot achshav sina'ah. Even though in the time of the Avot, the Matseva, the pillar, was a perfectly acceptable way of worshiping God, it was Ahuva, it was beloved, Nonetheless, because of the appropriation of that ritual act into the world of idolatry, it became something that God hated. So I would say to you, that comment right there already shows us that, whether we like it or not, our Mesorah already acknowledges the fact that some dynamic like that is in place. Now, how we prevent that here, I don't pretend to have any better examples than you, even if I would say you are forced to acknowledge, even against your will, that that plays out, as Rashi points out here. The question of how does that continue to unfold? How do we make those kinds of judgments? And how do we decide what God hates at this moment or that moment? Knowing that potentially that changes does not necessarily tell me how it is exactly at this moment. That is a much more complicated question that I don't pretend to necessarily have the answer to. It's perhaps because of questions like that, that for the most part we come from a tradition that does not just try to open up the Tanakh and arrive at some kind of broad general answer, which is why next week we will be moving to the sugya in the Gemara that is actually going to try to play out in more grounded, more rabbinic language, how might we think about some of this same conflict in more rabbinic and concrete terms, where I feel that there is a divine command manifested here through halachic literature that is conflicting with what seems to be a basic tenet of kvod habriyot, of human dignity in some way. Maybe that'll give us a little more grounding, and that's the cliffhanger for you to come back next week. Thank you very much.